Well, good morning. This is Per Fagren, KBOO News and Public Affairs, and our guest is Richard Heinberg, the author of The Party's Over, and more recently, Power Down. Richard will be in Portland Friday and Saturday. Friday, he will be at the First Unitarian Church, talking about peak oil, the challenge and opportunity of petroleum's waning days. And that's Friday, January 20th, 7:30 at the First Unitarian Church, and the charge is $12 at the door. Saturday, there'll be a one-day workshop, Peak Oil, Defining Local and Global Responses. That's something all our politicians should be going to. Saturday, the 21st, at Friends Meeting House on 42nd and Stark. And advanced registration is required, and the workshop is a $65 admission. And you can get details from www.livingearthgatherings.org. So having got all that out, well, Richard, are you there?
Yes.
Well, welcome to KBOO once again.
Good to be speaking with you, Per.
Okay, well... What, you know, the challenge and opportunity, I suppose the opportunity of the sort of imminent end of petroleum is something that Andrew was talking about earlier about global warming. I think it seems to me a couple of years ago some scientists in Sweden said the only thing that can save us from global warming is peak oil.
Yes, well, I wish I could be so sanguine. I think peak oil is a problem that has to be dealt with to a certain extent on its own. The two certainly are related. Both are consequences of our reliance on fossil fuels. And the solution to both will be similar in that we will have to reduce our use of oil and other fossil fuels. But I think there's a certain nuance in the way we're going to have to deal with peak oil, which is by way of what I'm calling an oil depletion protocol. The nations of the world are going to have to agree to reduce to use less oil. And at the same time, we're going to need a strengthened Kyoto Protocol to make sure that as we're doing that, we're not simply substituting coal and natural gas for oil.
Right. I might add that some people say the Swedish scientists are being unduly optimistic.
Yes, because if you know, as oil runs out, yes, we'll use less of this stuff. But if we just substitute coal for oil, then in fact we'll just make the climate problem even worse.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, there are some who say that apparently there is a sort of a rationing program already in effect, that the International Energy Agency has some kind of a treaty or agreement with all the major nations of the world saying that if we do get into an oil emergency, certain steps will follow, including a kind of allocation of this dwindling resource. Do you know anything about that?
Well, what the IEA has is a publication, it's about a 100-page book for its member nations called Saving Oil in a Hurry, and it offers a good critical analysis of what measures would help countries, member countries, to reduce their oil usage in short order if prices spike further. And it includes things like driving bans on alternate days, so that if your car license plate ends on an even number, you could drive Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. If it ends on an odd number, you can only drive on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and so on. And as I say, it analyzes how successful each of these various measures would be. So that this is helpful information not only for nations, but also, I think, for local communities, because we're going to need to implement some things like this. But on the larger scale, in terms of rationing, right now we're on the track toward one kind of rationing only, and that is price rationing. In other words, as prices go higher, whole segments of society will find it impossible to pay for fuel, and on a global level that means whole countries, and this is going to hit the less industrialized countries the hardest. Countries like Guatemala that use a lot of oil to generate electricity with are going to be hit very hard. And what they're most likely to do is to substitute coal for oil in that instance.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing about price rationing is it could very quickly lead to a situation where people are freezing in their homes. Meanwhile, other people are going on Caribbean cruises.
That's right. And so I think what we really need is a different kind of rationing, a quota rationing, where quotas would be tradable, so that if you're a truly conservative person, I don't like the way we use that word conservative in our political discourse these days, because it usually means just the opposite. But if you're a truly conservative person and you use very little fuel, then you could sell your quota on the open market and benefit economically, financially, whereas somebody else who still wants to drive their monster truck and live in a 4,000 square foot house and turn up the furnace to 80 degrees, well, they could still do that, but they'd have to pay a lot extra. So this would be kind of an ongoing transfer of wealth from the from heavy users of energy to the light users of energy. I think that's the right way to do rationing.
Mm-hmm. What about people, say, who live in Montana, where it's 150 miles from one town to the next? I mean, would they get any kind of a little allowance for that, or are they just sort of on their own?
Well, something like that could be worked out, but you know, we're going to have to be creative about this. If folks are living in really remote areas, they're going to have to think of ways of dealing with that. And there are some very good ideas that are being batted around right now, having to do with car sharing, car co-ops, community supported hitchhiking, and so on. Ultimately, you know, we're just not going to be able to operate 200 million private automobiles in this country. Mm-hmm. So the sooner we start making other plans, the better off we'll be.
Well, one of the things I've been thinking a lot about is just what it does to agriculture, because, you know, the agribiz now uses so much oil for its running its machinery, and also for pesticides and fertilizers and everything else. You know, it's like an enormous dead end that agriculture is in, and all, you know, that may change very quickly. I suppose, you know, if you had rationing where farmers would be allowed their fuel for a while to bridge the gap, that could help. But agriculture is going to have to change.
It is, definitely. Right now, the U.S. Department of Agriculture is advising farmers to economize on their fertilizer use for next year. Because fertilizer is made from natural gas, and as we all know, natural gas prices are way up right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, agriculture is going to have to change fundamentally. Now, farmers, I think, will be able to produce some of their own fuel from crops like canola, soy, and plant waste, producing methanol, ethanol, and biodiesel. I don't think that biofuels will be able to produce enough biofuels to run any substantial fraction of the U.S. car and truck fleet, but I think biofuels could be useful on the farm, and they're relatively easy to make, so farmers could set aside, you know, a couple of acres to grow fuel for their farm machinery, and that would help them out, I think.
What about hemp farms?
Good idea. We certainly should be legalizing the stuff for industrial use. And well, I personally don't think we have any business criminalizing plants.
Right. Uh huh. Well, I mean, it can be used for food, fuel, oil, clothing, lumber products. A whole lot of uses for hemp.
Right. Absolutely. Now, some people get on a high horse about this and say, well, if we were to grow hemp, we could, solve all of our problems and grow all of our fuel and so on. That's an exaggeration.
Mm-hmm.
It would certainly help, and we should be doing that. But we have to see biofuels as part of a much larger strategy, and the main part of that strategy has to be simply reduction of demand.
Mm-hmm. Right. What about animal waste? Right now, so much animal waste goes into the water table in our rivers. You know, these huge feedlots just overwhelm the you know, sort of the carrying capacity of the neighborhood.
Right. Well, yes, of course, animal waste and human waste should be, we could be processing these for, to produce methane digesters, and some farmers already do this on a small scale. Again, we're talking about a fairly minor supplement to what we're already using in terms of natural gas and oil. These things will help, and ultimately we have to understand that we are powering down to a much lower energy level economy. And all of that energy ultimately is going to have to come from renewable sources. So we're saying two things at the same time, really. First of all, we have to develop these renewable sources, but at the same time, when we get to that stage where we're just using renewable sources of energy, society is going to look very different from how it does now, because those renewable sources of energy will not enable us to do the kinds of things that we have gotten used to doing with fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to really change our expectations about life a great deal.
Well, I think basically we're going to have more people working on the land, and there's different ways of doing that, you know, gardens, community gardens, small farms, all sorts of things. I have a feeling that the people who are running our country right now would, their reasoning would tend towards prison farms or something like that.
Right. Well, you know, historically, fossil fuels have been so amazingly cheap and abundant that we've been motivated to replace human labor in every instance we possibly could with fuel-fed machinery. As recently as 150 years ago, roughly 80% of the work being done in the U.S. was being done by muscle power, by muscles of animals and humans. Now it's all being done by machines. Yes, it doesn't mean people aren't working anymore, but the contribution of muscle power to the work that actually gets done in the U.S. economy is negligible. It's less than 1%. So as fossil fuels go away, we are going to need more human labor. You're absolutely right. So the question is, how is that going to happen? Is it going to happen in a way that enables people to do work that they find enjoyable and healthy, or is it going to be, a trudge back into the workhouses and forced labor and slavery, in fact, that we've experienced in past centuries? This should be a subject of political debate.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, as been said by a lot of people, that the real solutions are not going to come down from the federal government. They're going to come from local communities. Now, down in your neighborhood, the town of Willits has been doing a lot of planning for this.
Can you tell Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And also, my students at New College and I are working with the mayor and city council of Sebastopol, which is another town here in Northern California, to develop a power-down plan for the city. We're also putting on a conference in May for the city councils and mayors of all the communities in Sonoma, Marin, and Mendocino counties. It's at the local level where I think we can do most, and where we're going to have to do as much as we can, because we really can't look to the federal government at this point for any leadership on this issue.
What about the chicken farms in Petaluma? It just popped in my mind.
Most of those are gone, I have to say.
Really?
Most of Sonoma County is just grape growing these days.
Oh, okay.
I think there are still some chicken farms left there, but it's not a huge industry. But you know, we're going to have to support our local agriculture wherever we can, and diversify it as much as we can. Those local farmers are our future, and we need them to stay in business.
So what are some of the things that they are doing in Willits? That's a little town of, what, about 10,000 people?
Even fewer than that, actually. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty small town. But they're doing a thorough study on how and where they're vulnerable to higher energy costs, and then how they can make a systematic change with regard to all of the things that the municipality itself is responsible for, things like emergency services and emergency vehicles, city buildings, trash pickup, those sorts of things. And then the people of the community, how will they fare as energy prices skyrocket? So they're looking at things like local food security, local water security, revitalizing the local economy, and so on. And this is the kind of process that I think can be replicated in towns and cities across the country. Denver, Colorado is beginning to undertake a similar study. Kinsale, which is a town in Ireland, is probably the furthest along of any community in the world in this.
Oh, really? What's the name of that town again?
Kinsale. That's K-I-N-S-A-L-E. And if you do a Google search for Kinsale and energy, you'll come up with their energy descent plan, which has been produced over the last couple of years by some students and college professors there in town, and has now been adopted by the town council.
Okay, well, now when you come to Portland, are you going to sort of talk about things that people can do here in Portland? You know, it's a city of about 500,000 people, not quite as big as, say, San Francisco, but...
Right.
What about the cities?
Absolutely. This is my main concern these days as I travel around and give talks in different places. We need vibrant citizen groups to begin looking at revitalizing local economies and local food security and so on. But we also need to be working with our municipal officials, educating them, helping them to grapple with the facts of peak oil and how the community can adapt and respond. It's analogous, I think, to the situation in New Orleans prior to Katrina. Everyone there knew that the city was vulnerable, that a hurricane would come, that it would ultimately be devastating. And the folks there had a choice to ignore that likelihood or to prepare for it. We know that peak oil is coming, just like Hurricane Katrina. We can see it on the horizon. In fact, the global oil production statistics right now suggest that we may be very close to that peak if we're not there currently. So it's really up to us, and it's especially up to local officials who are. That's their job, is to protect their communities and plan for their long-term survival and health.
Well, I know we have a local peak oil group here in Portland, and they meet. Actually, they are meeting tonight. They meet every Wednesday at St. Francis Church Dining Hall, which is on Pine between 11th and 12th. And I think they're having a tool maintenance discussion tonight, but they've had movies. Last week they had one of the Metro counselors who was interested. He's also educated, because there were a lot of stuff he didn't know also. And
yes.
So here in Portland, you know, we have a light rail system, you know, that could conceivably be used for transporting food and other things into the cities.
Absolutely. Portland has already done so much. It's in terms of the larger U.S. cities over 250,000, Portland has probably done more than any other mid-sized to large American city to develop public transportation, to restrict sprawl growth, and so on. All of these are very important efforts, and I think the people of Portland will benefit from these efforts and be very proud of them in the future. But certainly more has to be done in Portland, as everywhere else, because the challenge of peak oil is absolutely enormous, and it is going to change our entire way of life.
Well, yeah, of course. Even if even if the peak is 20 years away, that just gives us 20 years is not a lot of time to to get all this kind of stuff in operation.
That's right. And we know that from actually a U.S. government report just released about a year ago, commissioned by the U.S. Department of Energy. U.S. DOE asked Science Applications International Corporation to come up with a report saying, well, how bad a problem is peak oil and how long will it take us to deal with it? And the report they got back, I think, was maybe a little more than they were asking for, because they've pretty much buried it. For many months, it was only available on a high school website. But the Hirsch report says, essentially, we need at least 20 years to prepare for peak oil. And it's a problem of unprecedented scale, both for the economy, for society, and geopolitically as well.
Is there any place you can get a copy of that report besides downloading it?
If you do a Google search for Hirsch, H-I-R-S-C-H, the Hirsch report, and maybe add a word like oil or petroleum to that, you're going to find it. It's up, for example, on the projectcensored.org website.
Okay. You know, in your book, you talk about one strategy, the horrible strategy you call last man standing, which seems to be the strategy our federal government is pursuing right now. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we human beings have a tendency to fight over scarce resources, we've fought many oil wars already, in fact. World War II, although it was obviously fought over ideological differences and so on, from a strategic point of view, was very much an oil war. Japan was seeking more oil in order to continue to industrialize. Germany needed more oil, and the Allies were able to vanquish both countries essentially by cutting off their sources of fuel. Now, the Middle East is a source of considerable conflict. We're seeing civil wars in a number of countries around the world over their oil resources in West Africa and elsewhere. As oil peaks and the supply can no longer meet demand, as prices skyrocket, we are likely to see even more wars over oil, and they're likely to get, I think, much, much worse. Wars between consuming nations like the U.S. and China, wars between producers and consumers, in some cases relatively poor producing nations and relatively rich consuming nations. Unless we adopt something like the oil depletion protocol, which I was talking about earlier, I think that's the only way that we're going to avoid, in effect, a World War III or World War IV over oil.
Well, of course, war uses up a lot of oil anyway. I was just reading something interesting that apparently Brazil has announced a major oil field discovered with a 700 million barrel oil field.
Right. Yes, Brazil is one of the countries of the world that's having the most luck in finding oil right now, and that's mostly in deep water offshore. Some 700 million barrels is a large discovery in recent terms. Now, global oil discoveries have been declining since the early 1960s. Back in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, we were finding oil fields with 10, 20, 50 billion barrels of oil in them. These days, 700 million barrels sounds like a big discovery. And we have to remember the world uses 85 million barrels of oil per day. So we're talking about,
100 days, 150 days?
Something like that, yeah. A little bit less than that. Mm-hmm. So maybe 2.5 months worth of oil.
Well, of course, if Brazil has any smarts, they will sort of hang on to that oil and use it for Latin America, you know, in conjunction with Venezuela and Bolivia and other countries that they are allying themselves with.
As a matter of fact, one of Brazil's officials recently said that he believed that for Brazil to export any of its oil would be tantamount to treason. Now, if other countries in the world start taking this attitude, which I think is entirely reasonable. I mean, burning oil for fuel is, an official from one of the oil companies once said that it's similar to burning Van Gogh paintings to heat your house. I mean, oil is so incredibly valuable for so many things, and we're just burning the stuff up as fast as we possibly can. It's an enormously important economic resource for all kinds of reasons. So if the oil-producing countries start to realize what a valuable resource they have and start withholding it from the world market, as in fact I think they should, at least to a certain extent, then we're likely to see oil prices rise to a level that maybe reflects the true value of this stuff.
Well, it looks right now, it looks like Russia and China and Iran are kind of forming some sort of an alliance, and perhaps India might be in on that alliance, too. And what kind of oil is available in the United States is really problematic, because Iraq has never gotten anywhere near the production they used to have. And I don't know, you know, the Saudi Arabian oil seems to be, some say it's peaking right now, that their largest oil field is kind of running dry, essentially.
Right.
Yes,
well, this is why some of us are saying that the peak may not be 20 years away, mm-hmm. that in fact we may be seeing it very soon. Statistics seem to be saying that conventional oil, regular conventional oil, probably peaked in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And if you add in deep water oil, polar oil, natural gas liquids and condensates, the Canadian tar sands, and all of those non-conventional petroleum resources, we may be able to eke out some gains for another year or two or four at the most. We should really assume that we're at peak oil right now and right. start acting accordingly.
Time to start is 20 years ago.
Yes, that's right.
Well, okay, you will be in town Friday at the First Unitarian Church, a public talk on peak oil, the challenge and opportunity of petroleum's waning days, and then also doing a one-day workshop at Friends Meeting House on 43rd and Stark. Well, thank you very much for being with us and warning us once again. You know, the people to warn, of course, are the ones who are really running things in this country, but we have to keep
that's right. Well,
them.
It's pretty hard to talk to those folks, so I think we're going to have to work mostly with the folks we can talk to, which is each other and our local officials.
Okay, thank you very much. We've been talking to Richard Heinberg, the author of The Party's Over and Power Down, who will be in Portland Friday and Saturday. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Per.
Listening to KBOO in Portland. The time is 11 o'clock. And time now for Democracy Now!
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212 or on the web at radiocab.net.